We're in Ezekiel 28.
Okay.
And Ezekiel 28. And we read the first 10 verses, and actually we were getting into the second part of it. But just to remind us about the context, most people who study this passage break it up into two sections, the first section being the first 10 verses, which concern the Prince of Tyre. And the word there for prince is a Hebrew word, Nagid. It's different than the word for king, which is Melech. So anyway, when he gets to verse 11, then there's kind of a break, because you'll notice in verse 11, well, the end of verse 10, it says, "For I have spoken, says the Lord God." And then verse 11, it starts, "Moreover," and that's why often in the translations you'll see people break the paragraphs apart there, and they'll put like a heading.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's kind of a break in the delivery, and that break is where it appears that things change a little, because up till then it talks about the prince, and then in verse 11, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre." And so there's this sense in which the human figure is both a prince and a king. But the break in how it's delivered is a hint, potentially, that the second part of it goes a little further. And when you look at what's said in the second part, there are some things said that they're either enormous hyperbole or they're going beyond the king to take in the spiritual force that's behind the king. And so... And so at the time that this was given, the Prince of Tyre was this guy named Ethbaal III. But I think as we look at this passage, you'll see there's parts of it that have a lot of similarity to other passages of Scripture, which we'll look at, that talk about Satan, and then also this figure who's empowered by Satan at the time of the end, the Antichrist, what we call the Antichrist. So who wants to read for us, like, verses 11 through 19? Again.
Okay. Again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus says the Lord God, You have the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the lapis lazuli, the turquoise, and the emerald, and the gold. The workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. You were the anointed cherub who covers, and I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you by the abundance of your trade. You were internally filled with violence and you sinned. Therefore I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God, and I have destroyed you, O covering cherub, in the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I put you before kings, that they may see you. By the multitude of your iniquities, in the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuary. Therefore I have brought fire from the midst of you. It has consumed you, and I have turned you to ashes on the earth. In the eyes of all who see you, all who know you among the peoples, all appalled at you. You have become terrified, and you will cease to be forever."
So, there, like we've seen before, there's things in here that look like they apply to the man, the king, and then other things that look pretty astonishing. You know, like you were in Eden, the garden of God, for example, would be, or you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and beauty. right? That's not something you typically hear God say. And then he talks, he uses this terminology, you are the anointed cherub who covers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not typically said of a man that, that we can find elsewhere in Scripture. And so it appears that this is one of those places where God's kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit, and he's getting at this whole, it's kind of a bigger theme, but this theme that you see in Scripture that presently the prince of this world, pretty much, I mean, he's called the prince of, God of this age, the prince of this world, whatever, and he, you remember when Jesus, one of the temptations that Jesus had was he offered to give Jesus the kingdoms of the world. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And, that's in Matthew 4. I've got it here. But he basically, the devil took Jesus up onto a... Why is this not working like it's supposed to? There. Oh. What? What's that?
Cold.
So anyway, the devil takes Jesus up onto a high, exceedingly high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory. And in a parallel passage in one of the other Gospels, it includes a phrase that gives you the impression that he sees either all the kingdoms at a moment in time around the world, or he sees, you know, a vision of all the kingdoms through history. Depends on how you want to interpret that, what it says. But the idea is that Satan goes up and shows him all these kingdoms, and then he says in verse 9, Satan says, all these things I will give you if you'll fall down and worship me.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jesus says, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. So, there's a couple of things there, of course, that you see right off in that whole passage. One is that Jesus doesn't argue about whether, he doesn't argue with Jesus, Satan, about whether he has the authority to give these things. And you also see things about Satan that he has these kingdoms under his authority to some degree. Obviously, everything anyone does is under ultimately the authority of God, right? We know that. So, but beyond that, Satan has control and authority over these kingdoms, and then he also is seeking worship. And in this passage, and in another passage we'll look at, you see those same ideas, that both these people that are brought into focus in these two passages are kings. And in both passages there's aspects where it's clear that Satan's self-concept and desire to be somebody, you know, be worshipped, especially in the other passage in Ezekiel 14 we'll be looking at, or Isaiah 14, that he desires to be worshipped, and that part of this whole aspect of him, this iniquity that it talks about, is related to him wanting to displace God, him wanting, a jealousy, if you will, between, you know, what God wanted him to be, and where he himself wants to be is different. So, like in verse 15, you were perfect in your ways from the day you were created, and prior to that it says you are the anointed cherub who covers.
Mm-hmm.
So in verses 14 and 15 you get this definite picture that God is saying, especially how he describes him in the previous verses too, that he was possibly the most exalted and glorious created creature. And I don't mean exalted in the sense that God wanted him to receive worship or anything.
Right.
I just mean as far as how the perfection and height of wisdom and appearance that God gave him. And so you see this whole thing triggered out here, or comes into play here, this idea that the dominion that man was supposed to have fell into the hands of Satan, and then Satan is using that dominion to try and receive worship. Yeah.
On 14, where it says you walked in the midst of the stones of fire,
mm-hmm.
What exactly are we kind of referring to? Because I'm thinking fire, judgment, da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just, you know, this... Yeah, no, no. I just kind of wanted to know what the take is on that.
Right. So,
it means all the stones and the areas.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of the descriptions where it talks about Eden, the Garden of God, it doesn't look the same as the descriptions of the Garden of Eden that we see in the beginning, right? And so that has led people to say, well, that the Garden of God, or the Garden of Eden, the concept of the Garden of Eden, is expressed in a couple different ways, like in the beginning of Genesis, you see it in the sense of, you know, a beautiful kind of like a, what would you call it, a paradise on earth with trees and lush vegetation and so on. And then there are other passages where the Garden of God and Eden are used to describe the earth, what's going on the earth right now. So the nations, in a sense, the nations and the peoples of the world are God's garden. And there's phrases where it talks about, you know, like the trees of Lebanon and things like that. So it's this idea that everything that comes forth through history is really God's garden as well. And then these passages where it talks about the stones and the light and so on seem to refer to a heavenly setting that may differ from the actual, you know, what we think of the Garden of Eden, to where it talks about, it says, you walk back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. Some people see that as an allusion to the descriptions of the sea of glass and the light and stuff that shines through there, right, like in heaven.
So is your translation also fire? Or
fiery
is there
stone.
Light?
Fiery stone.
Fiery
stone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. So some see it as a heavenly scene that's different even than what we would call the Garden of Eden,
right,
in the beginning of...
Okay, so you're talking more light than fire here. I mean, the fire light.
Right.
Than fire burning.
Right.
Okay.
You know, if you look up in verse 13, you were in Eden, the Garden of God, every precious stone was your covering, right? And it gives these stones.
Mm-hmm.
And the stones are quite possibly literal stones, just like in the breastplate and, you know, and in the foundation of Revelation, but if you go and read the passages in the end of the book of Revelation, part of one of the things that it seems to emphasize is the colors related to the stones, just like in, I think it's Revelation 5, where it talks about the rainbow around the throne and some of the stones there. So the stones are beautifully colored, translucent, and there's this idea of beautiful light and glory and reflecting. You know, it's not just like blue and purple rocks, I don't think. It could mean that, but it seems like it's going beyond that to try and describe gems. It's saying, like, consider gem, all these different colored gemstones in bright light and how they reflect and light goes through them and everything. And that's kind of the picture you get of the New Jerusalem when it gets described, right? So when it talks about, you know, you were cast down.
Yeah, because it's saying you're on the holy mountain of God.
Right, you're on the holy mountain of God and you were cast down, right? You're cast down as a profane thing. Well, so he and then again, some people believe that, what that's talking about is that he lost his position as the anointed cherub who covers. I mean, he's Satan, and he still has access, we know from the book of Job and the New Testament, but he's no longer the anointed cherub who covers. And we'll look a little bit more at what that may mean, but he's not in this role that God originally put him in to be really, really close to God and performing a function related to, you know, close into God like the living creatures that you see, that we see earlier in Ezekiel. They're around the chariot,
right,
or in Revelation. So there's this idea that the most glorious creatures are the ones that are close, have closest access to God, and tend to perform a function that is more holy and more special. And it's the whole picture throughout the scripture, which is every creature, the highest thing any creature can have is to be closer to God, which is what we should be thinking too, right? So there's a lot of mystery in this passage. Different ideas about it, but part of it too is you can see elements, like when it talks about here, it talks about the Garden of Eden, and it mentions you were on the holy mountain of God. Well, if you remember when you read, so it's implying that whatever the Garden of Eden is in here, if it's a heavenly one, some of the things are parallel. And when you get to the Garden of Eden on earth, the one that we would really definitely know is the Garden of Eden, it mentions there's rivers that flow from there. There's the source of rivers that flow from there. And the implication is it's elevated, right? That's not really discussed much, but it's probably a mountain. It's probably a mountain because the rivers go down from that source. Mm-hmm. And the picture, as you study the Bible more and more, you see the picture that that Garden of Eden is a picture of a meeting place between God and man, which comes to be the tabernacle and the temple and so forth, right? And so that's why we'll see later in Ezekiel, when we get to this temple, we'll see there's a river flows out from the temple and goes out from there. And so many people have drawn the analogy that the Ezekiel's temple is on a mountain of God, high and lifted up, and living water flows from it, just like in the book of Genesis. And the implication here too is wherever these fiery stones were, that it had the same geography somehow. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, because like you said that the glory of any creature, it could be measured by its proximity to God, right? Mm-hmm. And he's called the covering cherub. I mean,
mm-hmm.
And then we had in the beginning of the book, we had the four creatures and the wheels,
mm-hmm.
And then it says in between them there's like
fire,
or like, what is it?
Yeah, I don't remember what it says. Find that part. Chapter 1 has it, chapter 10, I think.
Chapter 1.
Sorry.
So chapter 1, verse 13. In the midst of the living beings, there was something like, that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and lightning was flashing from the fire. The living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning. And
you also have that passage where the seraph takes the coal, right, and purifies the lips of the prophet. And so there's this idea that somewhat when God shows up, there's lightning and fire and brightness.
Yeah, so I was just wondering, like, if the fire might denote that the creature was one of the ones, he says it's covering chair, but like obviously it was one of the ones that in close proximity to God. I mean, maybe even part of that. Because at the end, there's four other creatures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wonder if he's just... If these guys are like a chariot, I wonder if he was like the roof or something.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know.
But he is called... Yeah, so he's called out...
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think an interesting thing to observe about it is everywhere else we see creatures close to God, they're plural and they have an equal status, like four, right? He's called the, you know, in there's an explicit there, the anointed, the cherub, the covering one. One. Is that what I'm saying is in the Hebrew it's emphasizing he's the only one that had this position and title. Yeah.
Or maybe, I don't know, this would be a weird idea, but like, he's got all the same gemstones that are supposed to be on the breastplate for the priest.
Mm-hmm. And the priest is an intercessor between God and man.
Right, and that's the covering
of
the priest.
Right. And so when you look at the phrase, the anointed cherub who covers, for example, the you know, and you know Christ means anointed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Messiah, Mashiach in Hebrew, means anointed. And so the idea of anointed is just like the high priest when they
separated.
Would pour the oil on the high priest, separated or consecrated.
Right, set apart.
So he's saying, you're the set apart
cherub.
And it says, who covers.
Right.
So if you think about cherubs and covering, what comes to mind from the Old Testament?
Cherubim and cherubim.
The two figures on the top of
the ark. Right. So the ark, so the Shekinah, or the glory of God, appears over the mercy seat in that Holy of Holies between those two angels, or whatever they are, cherubs, right? And so they're covering there. In this case, it's just him. But the implication is, if you think of that, you know, you go into the outer door of the court, then the inner court, and then you go through past the altar of incense. Then you go, you know, you're as you go closer, it's like going through a hall with all these doors, because you know it's a poor analogy. But the Wizard of Oz, you know, is behind the last curtain, kind of thing.
Something to get smart with.
So as you're going in, there's fewer and fewer people have access, and finally it's just the high priest once a year that can go in there, and even then he's got to have clouds of incense to separate him essentially from the holiness of God. That's the implication when it talks about
the
clouds
of incense.
Yeah,
you can't see.
Yeah, so it's not like completely clear, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this whole idea that as you approach God, you have this incredibly holy, perfect being who he's a consuming fire. Not because he's vindictive, because he's holy and super powerful, and he won't abide with sin, right? Which is why we saw earlier he left the temple, right? So this whole business about all this stuff that goes on from way back to till near the end, involving temples and animals and sacrifices and incense and bread and oil and lights, and all of that has to do with this business of we're separated from God by sin. And so this cherub did not have sin, right? And he was but so there's this point at which, but to start with, it appears that he was closer. I mean, I read this and I think it's saying he was closer to God than any other created being.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I heard that it say that possibly he was an archangel who was over all the other archangels, since it seems as though the structure that God has is like a military structure,
right?
You know, with a general and down the lines, and I've heard it said that it's like a like he's the main
commander.
One that's in charge of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also heard that because of the timbrels and the pipes that he actually led worship in heaven and things like that. I don't know if you tie those things together. I'm
yeah.
Sure nobody really knows, but it's...
Well, I think, you know, and there's difference, you'll see differences in the translations about whether those words are timbrels and pipes or not, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then what do you have in yours, verse 13, at the very end? The workmanship of your sockets and joints or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Gosh, I never did timbrels and pipes on that. I was
no.
thinking setting, like, set, you know, a ring
for stone.
Or something
yeah.
for a stone.
Right, like a ring.
Get,
right.
Yeah. I mean, that's
so,
instruments.
Okay,
yeah.
But I think Jerry's making a good point. Even so the King James takes it as timbrels and pipes. And a musical.
What's yours?
Timbrels
oh,
and pipes.
Okay. So New King James.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the translators of the New King James take those terms to have a musical connotation, related to worship.
Right.
And
I'm taking it that way.
You know, and I think it's, you know, if you look at Revelation 4 and 5, you know, where the living creatures are there and everybody casts their thrones and the whole multitude erupts and worship, it's clear that, you know, as you get close to God, there's a lot of worship going on just constantly. Because it talks about day and night. All they say is holy, holy, holy.
For those.
They're different Hebrew terms and they can be taken
so
different ways.
They can be either musical or not.
Mm-hmm.
What's the not then?
What's
the alternative, I guess?
Well, what's yours? What yours says right
there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So some take it as. Okay, so sockets and settings with stones, right? The implication
right, so you're just talking about a framework, basically, there?
No, well, okay, so when you see all those, it says that these precious stones were his covering.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the implication is that might have been his jewelry, if you will, divine jewelry that was granted to him. And so the workmanship includes the mounting. Like on your ring, right? When you look
yeah.
at your ring, there's this glorious, not on yours, but on most women's
mm-hmm.
rings, there's a glorious
yeah.
stone on there.
Mm-hmm.
Is there not a cheesecake?
Oh, no, there's a diamond on there. There's a diamond right over there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I was thinking, you know, mine says something, I thought it says that the stones were found within him.
The stones are within him?
Yeah, which I thought was also a weird thing.
His followers get stoned, but I don't know about
this. This is every precious stone was your covering.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
We've got covering.
So that would mean
okay.
it was out
five.
Why is
it different?
Yeah, well, yours is the NASB.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, it says your covering.
And same as,
that's
what David has.
Yeah.
I know, but there was something I thought that I read that
it
was within you.
That was the fire. That was the...
So you're saying these stones are something that he wore? Because the way it reads, it's mounting the setting, so like you said, the ring like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Something that holds the stones on it.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Crafted.
So I think if we saw him, I don't know exactly what it would look like, but it would be gem studded, brilliant.
Probably
right.
the most
mm-hmm.
glorious
yeah.
of God's creation.
Well, I think Jerry's got a good point that like this creature served a special purpose as far as like in its ministering to God. I mean, kind of like the high priest would. Is, you know, maybe a reflection of what goes on in heaven about who is supposed to, you know, minister to God in what way, and so
right.
this guy was like the head guy
right.
there, where
mm-hmm.
the high priest is the head guy
right.
down here.
And then all of this stuff caused pride, and because he was the best.
Yeah,
you know, he was like the guy doing the end zone.
He was
the
guy on whom was bestowed the most honor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the iniquity.
I found that part funny.
Okay.
In the gold, the workmanship of your settings and sockets within you. So see, it lists all these stones, and the gold, you know, it goes turquoise and emerald and the gold. The workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you.
Yeah.
And our set was prepared for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then mine goes on the day that you were created, they were prepared.
Yeah.
That's what the was in you that was messing me up.
Okay.
So in other words, it's good inside and out, because then later on it says you're internally filled with violence type thing. So it was kind of comparing, I suppose, inside you were pure and
lovely.
And da-da-da-da, along with being covered outside and all this stuff.
When you see conservative, you know, good conservative translations, like Sid's got the HCSB, you two are on the NASB, and then we've got the New King James. All three of those are really solid conservative. When they hit with quite different words or phrase somewhere, and they have the identical Hebrew, you know, manuscripts, obviously. So what that tells us is that there are terms that have difficulty associated with them to determine exactly what they mean, and they have a range of meaning, or they're used in different ways in different ancient documents to where there's some ambiguity potential about how to, and so they have to look at the context to try and determine, you know, and one of them's looking at the context and saying, I think it's talking about how these things are mounted, you know, and another one's looking at the context and saying, well, I think it's talking about his position in music.
Right. Yeah.
So this is why it's good to have different translations that are all conservative, so you don't get too far out by any of the varied ideas. But it basically tells you that some of these things are hard for people to know. It's just like some of the animals that are mentioned, you know, back in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, some of the different unclean or clean animals, you know, get like, you know, one place we'll talk about like the dugong skin or something, and another place we'll be talking about a rock badger, you know, or something. And you're like, well, wait a minute. You know, and even when you go back to, like, if you look at earlier translations by Jews themselves, like the Septuagint is a good example, where the Old Testament was translated into Greek by Jewish scholars in Alexandria, and even they have trouble figuring out what some of the Jewish words are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this issue where in some of these corner case situations, we'll see in Isaiah 14 a similar sort of thing. So part of the idea of this anointed cherub who covers was he was consecrated, set apart. He was the Messiah cherub. I mean, it sounds like a weird thing to say, but if you think about Messiah has taken on a bigger connotation because it includes deliverance. So that wouldn't lie here, but he's the anointed, he's the, you know, the Messiah cherub. He's the top cherub. And the term that's used there is, you know, when you read it in Hebrew, you get the idea of Messiah.
Yeah, Messiah and anointed is the same.
Yeah.
Well,
that's right.
So
he's Hebrew and Greek, right?
Yeah. So
yeah.
He's
Hebrew for Messiah and anointed is Greek.
Yeah.
Right. Same.
Well, anointed is English, but Christos is the Greek. Yeah.
Right. Right. Got it.
So the idea was that he was the closest one, which implies, you know, first off, it's singling out his uniqueness. It's describing and saying things, you know, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty, the seal of perfection. You know, that's
yep.
And that's inspired coming from God through Ezekiel. So it's like an incredible statement right there. I mean, he could have just quit at verse 11 and not even said verse 12, you know, and he'd still be, wow, right? And the idea of the covering, again, is this issue of the closer the creatures get to God, the more holy they are considered in their position. Obviously, all the angels are holy. They don't have sin. But but the ones that are closer are more glorious. And they're created with, you know, they're special. Like the four Zoa, they're just called Zoa. You know, if you think of zoology, right? Or protozoa, you know, in the lab, it just means life. And so the four living creatures, I mean, the translations are putting creatures in there. It just says the four living. You know, that's what it's saying. And and because he's the Prince of Life, and they're so close to him, they have this association with a life. And so the impression you get here from this is that we don't have a clue how glorious he was. And then there's a million questions that come up between this and the snake, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, we don't know if he, like, possessed the snake, or we just don't understand how, you know, what's she doing talking to the snake in the first place, and did the snake, what did the snake look like when it was a nachish, it's called, or whatever? Was it still a you know, because it's after that he's cursed to crawl on his belly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like, there's some of these things that, there, you know, it's like, you read a few sentences and you're hoping they're going to answer some questions, and they actually give you more questions than you had before you read it. Right? Mm-hmm. And this passage is kind of that way, because on the surface you can kind of run through it and see some things, but the more you think about it, like we were talking last week about this issue of, you were perfect in your ways until, you could spend years just looking at that whole issue of God creating things good and then iniquity being found, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that's just a huge issue in itself. But so this is one of those passages that raises a lot of those sorts of questions.
So through the abundance of your trade, it sounds like he was peddling something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does sound like he was peddling something, favors or something.
Uh-huh.
Or,
and there was found wickedness. That's where he got his wickedness, because he was maybe, maybe he's saying, if you worship me, I'll give you this, or whatever the case may be. There was wickedness in whatever he was doing.
Right, and then you think of the other situation of the controlling secretary. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that was the case here, but if you think of someone who has a lot of power and they have a gatekeeper,
mm-hmm.
right? So,
well, trade has to do with money, and there's love of God and love of money.
Yeah, but in general, trade has to do with the exchange of benefits,
mm-hmm.
right? In more general sense. So, you know, if you think of, it's not using those terms here, but if you think of blackmail, right? You think of the distortion of justice based on power and leverage and access, and it doesn't tell us exactly.
Mm-hmm. The it's not on that, but where it says the holy mountain of God, and then the references back to Ezekiel 20:40, and it talks about on my holy mountain, on the mountain height of Israel.
Right.
Is it mm-hmm. possible? I think some people believe that Eden was actually where Israel is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's possible maybe that he is talking about that particular spot on the earth, do you think?
It's possible, yeah. Because you have, there's so many, you know, like, it's like when David goes and buys that plot of land, right? That ends up being that many people believe that's the same place that Abraham offered his son,
yeah.
right? And that's the place where the temple got built. And so God definitely does have a pattern historically of commemorating places that have significance, and so there are people that believe that where the temple was, where you have to go from the east to go back in,
mm-hmm.
that's walking essentially on the same place, if you could establish it, where they were kicked out eastward of Eden.
Hmm.
And so coming into the temple is this idea of trying to come back into favor and association with God. Definitely the directions are aligned for sure, that they were kicked out eastward and they have to come from the east back in, and the glory of God comes back in that way too. But there's parallels there that God has purposely laid out how how exact the geography is, I'm one of those that's inclined to think that God is really clever, and we're going to be blown away when we find out all the details that he has arranged.
Do you think it would be possible that Satan was on the earth in the Garden of Eden before God created man?
I don't know. It just doesn't really say.
It speaks of being on the holy mountain and all these other things, the burning stones and that, all this stuff, and as though maybe it's a possibility. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's a possibility that before it was a garden, it was slightly different. But the sequence and the things that are said in Genesis don't really give us any hint.
Yeah,
of it.
No.
One thing I would be careful about there is, and I don't think that's where you're going at all, is there are people who separate the fall of Satan and then a long age before the creation of
the
man.
Gap there,
the gap, but also they take passages that in other parts of the Bible that talk about cities and things like that, and they apply them to a time before Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty big mistake. I think it's not really looking at the context of those passages. But yeah, you know, when it comes to the creation of the angels, the fall of Satan, and the angels that fell with him, the serpent, there's just a huge number of unknowns there. And so, you know, there's ideas we can explore and think about as individuals and stuff, but, you know, there's not a lot solid you can teach there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just have to suppose.
Yeah. And I think there's some insights you can get from thinking through some of those things, because you can start to see, you know, well, even in this passage, just the connection between this passage and the Isaiah, between the king and Satan, gives you a better understanding of the influence of certain world powers in history,
mm-hmm.
and how this whole business, this whole fight between man was given dominion, man essentially lost dominion. We are not even really told that much about that. It's kind of like when man's given dominion and then he falls, we don't hear that much about dominion. But later on, we see very clearly that Satan has dominion. And so we're kind of left going, how did that work? What are the details? And a lot of people have tried to study it out, and there's just not a whole lot it says. You know, you can imply certain things, but that's another area where, you know, when man sins, how is it that Satan became the god of this age? And how come he has control
of you? In Revelation, when the scroll was handed over, was that the title deed to the earth? Or?
I think that's part of what it is,
okay.
Yeah.
So if that was the case, then what happened when he fell, then the title with Satan, apparently, that's what, so I heard some people teach that. There, I don't think there's any correct.
Yeah, I would shy away from saying a title deed, because that implies ownership. I think the ultimate, I mean, the scroll is there and it's sealed. It's just somebody has to come open it.
Yeah.
But he's usurped, you know, he's kind of the squatter. He's sitting on the property, but maybe not really the owner, right?
Well, God's the owner.
Yeah. So anyway, when you see this business with the kings and stuff, you start to get a better appreciation for this idea that one of the reasons that, you know, one of the big things that God's trying to do, and when I say trying, it's a stupid word to say, God's trying to do this, but is one of the goals of God is righteous government. It's a big, big thing with God. And the throne of David, one of the big things about it is righteous government. He keeps talking about widows and orphans, mm-hmm. bribery, justice, innocent blood.
Mm-hmm.
So God has, you know, I don't know how many, but, you know, at least a dozen, you know, if you just off the top of your finger, he's like a dozen things that are big focuses with him. Redemption, right? dealing with the issue of sin, restoring the earth physically, spiritually, restoring things, justice and judgment, proper rule, relationships. There's all these things that he's focused on. And part of this business with Satan messing with the kings, essentially, is thwarting God's, what do you want to call it, his idea of a theocratic kingdom. In other words, God is the ultimate king, right? Is God king? Does he rule over everything? Yes. Will there ever not rule over every little inch of everything? No. But then there's this issue of representing God through another means, right? Which would be, you know, like the king on the throne of David, or Jesus when he walks on the earth and does the Father's will. There's this whole idea of God wanting to express his justice and his person on the earth in a practical way, right? Real government, not just spiritual government, real government. And so that whole issue brings up this issue where he puts man on the earth and he says, you have dominion. And there's a... Is that this? Anyway, when he says, you know, you have dominion, we kind of just think about it, well, yeah, we're going to manage fish and sheep and stuff like that, which is part of it. But there's this whole thing that God is saying, I want you to rule in my place. See? So he's saying, I want you to be me. This is your job, is to be,
yeah, salt and light.
You know, and this is like Jesus uses that thing. He says, it's written that you are God, right? He's talking about judges and stuff in that passage in the Old Testament. And the idea is that, you know, and this is where you have to really be careful how you say things, but he wants us to function and rule kind of like God as a surrogate.
Yeah.
Right.
The question I had, too, is, you know, you were talking about, but he says he is a guardian cherub. And he banished, from the mountain of God, I banished you, guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. So it sounds like he had some kind of...
Yeah, so you're in verse 14, is that where you are?
16. And I was kind of reading it in other places. It said, what did it say in New King James or something?
Covering. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was interesting, guardian.
Yeah.
So it sounded like he was protecting them out at some point, or is that guardian meaning what I'm thinking a guardian would be?
Well, there's a sense. Yeah, I think that the fact that the one translation uses covering and the other guarding is this idea that it has to do with access to God.
Okay. All right.
You know, just the same way like the veil, right? So like if you think of the temple, let's say that Mike's God down at that end of the table and I'm coming into the temple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got to go through all these things. And
you mentioned that. No.
There's a thing in which there's gatekeepers.
Right.
And as I go along, I've got to be more and more holy as far as sanctified, right? Like I could be the high priest, I could be clean, ritually clean and all that. But if I walk past that veil and it's not the Day of Atonement,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't, because I lost my cleanness by violating God's rules to go through there, right?
Okay.
So there's this whole, I mean, and I'm not saying that's the only way to take it, but I see it as just like the four Zoa, you know, in the scene in Revelation 4 and 5, you're not going to just jive by the four Zoa to go see God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's kind of a goofy idea about like bouncers, right?
Yeah. So he's not protecting God. What he's protecting is people coming to God in a sense. Back off.
I don't think
in a sense.
People, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't. I guess I would see it as he's again this whole idea, and I think you emphasize this all the time too. Whoever is God's minister, we minister to God,
uh-huh.
right? And so there's a sense in which, like even in worship, you know, like our worship team really shouldn't really be looking out at us, right? A worship team should have us behind them, and they should be singing to the wall, because that's really what they're
doing.
To
God.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but that's what
I
I'm
know,
saying. I'm just saying if you had a worship team inside the temple, which there wasn't, well, I guess there were some singers in some situations in the outer parts. I don't know for sure. I don't know a lot about that. But if there were, they wouldn't be, they'd be facing the Holy of Holies.
Same place.
Because they're ministering to God. And this is one of those things where Christians get goofed up a lot, is they start thinking that they're ministering to people, and there is an aspect of ministering to people, but the primary focus is minister to God, and then He ministers through you to people. But so there's this issue of, I think, of layers of access.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, that's just, I'm just drawing that more from other passages where it essentially talks about the fact that access to God is restricted because of who He is. You know, and if you think about that from the point of view of the first chapter of John, where it talks about, where John talks about Jesus being the Word and He was in the beginning, and then he says, it talks about that we have handled Him. He He dwelt among us. He tabernacled among us, and we handled Him. And I think part of what it's saying is that Jesus was God, is God incarnate, and we touched Him. And it's getting at this idea. I mean, it's not explicit, but it's getting at this idea. There was nobody in between. There was no anointed cherub holding us away, you know, both for our own good and because God's holy, you know, that we couldn't come in with. And that's why those passages in the Gospels where the lepers touch Jesus are so powerful. Because when a leper is a type of, you know, it's a model of the ultimate sin. We're all lepers. We're born lepers, essentially. And so when those lepers show up in the Gospels, just like the blind people, we're born blind. All these people in the Gospels that show up, they're basically saying, this is what you look like to God. And so when the blind guys know it's the Son of David, and the sighted people can't figure out who He is, right? Or in the case of the lepers come in and they're supposed to say unclean, unclean, and they got to stay away from everybody. Or the woman with the issue of blood, she's unclean too. And they come in and they touch. They come in and they touch God, or the hem of His garment she touches, but they touch God, or, you know, so a leper comes in, and in that moment where the leper is touching Jesus, it's just huge. It's like the whole effort of the Bible over hundreds of years of history is like punctured for a minute. Because it's got this super sinful, the leper isn't any more sinful than anyone else, but the representation of the horridness of leprosy, and he's touching the divine person with nothing in between. No courts, no walls, no washings, no animals, no priests, no incense, you know, no veil. And so that whole separation and the puncturing of that separation is in a sense what the Bible is all about. And so I think here, and part of this issue is, it's basically saying that this particular individual had the closest access to God, and part of that may have been, as well as we see, just like the priests, like if you look at the camp of Israel, right around the tabernacle are the Levites. And then as you go into the tabernacle, there's only certain Levites in certain positions doing certain things, and then you get to the high priest and all that. But the people that are closest to God are ministering to God. They're directing the sacrifices, the worship, and so forth. And so there's the same picture you get, that even though all the angels are ministers, the angels that are closer to God are focused more. You know, like if we just go to Revelation 4, for example. Oh gosh. Mm. so, you know, like in verse in 8, the four living creatures, each having six wings, were full of eyes around and within, and they do not rest day and night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." So right off the bat, you can see, what are these things doing? What's one of their functions? It's 24/7 worship. And whenever they give glory and honor, the 24 elders fall down, right? And so there's this whole idea that the closer that you get to God, the more focus there is on Him, and the greater ministry focus toward Him because of His magnificence. And so it's like so hard for us, I think, to get a good picture of, because God is just so magnificent that we just can't conceive of what it's like to be there and be in that presence, and how overwhelming. I mean, we see little pictures of it, right? We just can't get a really good picture. It's like when God, who was really close to Moses, and Moses says, "I want to see your glory." Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, they have all these things where the genie shows up with a little jar, "Grant me three wishes, or, well, not three wishes, but three wishes." And the guy says, "I want $1,000 or $1,000,000, right? And all the deer are all over in the yard. So, but the thing is that if you take that analogy, there's only one wish that anyone would ever have. If God said, "You can have anything," if we really understood God, and God says, "You could have anything, what's your one wish?" The answer from everyone would be to be close to you. You know, I don't understand that. I have some idea of little pieces of it, but I don't understand it. But clearly that's what the Bible is saying. The Bible is saying the highest blessing anyone, anything can have is to be closer to God. If you're this close, get closer. If you're this close, get closer. And so there's a sense in which He's light, He's life, He's just all these things that we just can't get a hold of in our heads.
What you said there made me come to think about the two apostles were wanting to be on His right and His left. He says, "I can't give you that. That's only my Father in heaven can do that. So it's granted to you." When you said that, that's what.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think that is a good point that underscores this issue of, like Jerry was talking about, the hierarchy, you know, the authority structure. That God has an authority structure in the family, He has it in the government, and He has it in heaven, too. So anyway, there's a lot in this passage, but unless anyone had other things, I thought it'd be good to pop over to look at Isaiah 14, because it's real similar. Maybe someone can read verses 3 through 15 for us.
Okay. And it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you have been enslaved, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, "How the oppressor has ceased, and how fury has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. they break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. They will all respond and say to you, even you have made weak, or even you have been made weak as we, you have become like us. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you. Worms are your covering. You, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn, you have been cut down to the earth. You have, are you who have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you shall be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit.
Thanks, David. So you can see that this is real similar sort of construction to Ezekiel 28, where it starts out on a king, and there's a bunch of things said there that apply to a mortal, right? But then it goes like in verse 12, there's a definite focus there that switches, says that this person that's being addressed in verse 12 has fallen from heaven.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fallen from heaven. How many? You know, unless it's a figure of speech, you know, how many people have fallen from heaven? And then you get these verses in 13 and on that are pretty incredible. You know, I will ascend into heaven. I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God. It's some consider to be a reference to the angels. And even going to this business, I will be like the Most High in verse 14.
It's almost like this is after this over here. It's almost like this is, you know, after when it's because it's talking about ascending back into heaven afterwards.
Yeah, after the fall.
You know, it seems like there's a time thing in there.
Right, like he's cast out, and then now I'm going
to
send
back.
And so over here, it's not that way, I don't think. It didn't seem that way to me.
Right.
Like he wants to be the leader of the angels again. He wants to sit on the mount of the assembly, which is the mountain of God.
Yeah, but somebody says, how are you fallen from heaven?
Mm.
Yeah, the presumption is he's already fallen, verse 12. Whereas what we read before was describing getting kicked out.
Yeah.
Like, you were perfect until iniquity.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a valid observation for sure, that this is looking like a little bit further along.
Although this is still talking about the king of Tyre now?
No, this is Babylon.
Okay, Babylon.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So this would be, at the time this was given, this would be Nebuchadnezzar.
Right. The same tower behind
So again, you see kings, but you see there's this power behind, and of course there's, like I was mentioning before, there are Christians you'll run into who vehemently argue that neither of these passages have anything to do with Satan. they especially don't like the New King James translators. You know, where it's actually not. So in verse 12, the New King James says, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people say, well, they just stuck his name in there. But actually, you know, these guys needed this translation, right? That was after the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate. And the Latin Vulgate, in Latin, Lucifer means light bearer.
Mm.
Or
you can...
Yeah.
Like the destroyer of nations.
Yeah. So the idea of Lucifer, the phrase there really means shining one, son of the morning. Shining one being light bearer. So you can think of Lucifer as is an analogous to Christopher. Christopher means Christ bearer. Lucifer means light bearer.
Mm.
And so Lucifer in there is a good translation. It's not like, oh, they just decided it was Satan, they want to stick his name in there. They're just using a Latin phrase, essentially, that was very familiar at the time that they translated, you know. I mean, today, Lucifer, the name Lucifer, we know the term Lucifer, obviously, mm-hmm. but people who worship Satan use that term because they truly believe he is light,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right?
Like, here's a good example here. License plate, Debbie and I took a picture of
mm-hmm.
over
oh, man.
In front of us as we were going over U.S. 2.
Wow.
Hail Satan. And you know what? Good old Republican. Not all that is conservative is
mm-hmm.
good. But here we're driving over. So I had that thing in my face for miles.
Yeah, a little Subaru.
I'm like, Debbie, get your camera. Try to get a picture of that thing.
She's
like, we're juggling all over the road. She's got it zoomed, you know. But, you know, I wasn't actually going to talk about that right now, but you can see in this passage especially that Satan wants worship.
Mm-hmm. God welcome.
Yeah, and so here we are in 2016 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We're like thousands and thousands of years away from all this stuff.
It hasn't changed.
And here we are in the modern world, driving in these automobiles that nobody would have ever dreamed there was an automobile or a freeway you could drive over the mountain
mm-hmm.
in like an hour and a half or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And what's this guy got strapped on the back of his car?
It's a girl.
Well, I don't remember, but Hail Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, are you kidding me?
I probably wouldn't even have noticed it.
And of course, when you see the people who are kind of pro-Satan today, at least the ones that are out in the open in the news and stuff, they all claim, well, we're atheists and we're just trying to promote a different idea
mm-hmm.
and we don't really worship, we don't believe in a Satan.
Okay.
Well, that might be how it starts,
yeah.
But this is the thing, like if you weren't a believer in the Bible, explain to me in the age of enlightenment, why mm-hmm. do we have a license plate like that?
Right.
Right? Yeah, it's a stupid thing. It's just something somebody stuck on the back of their car, and people are goofy, they do whatever they want. But why hasn't this been laid to rest thousands of years ago? Why is this still going on? And why do we see Satan clubs now wanting to get into stupid schools?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's a part of it that's pathetic and laughable, and there's a part of it that's not at all pathetic and laughable, because it's real. It's real. And it's evidence. Isaiah 14 is still going on today.
Mm-hmm.
He wants worship.
Yeah. Especially 12 through 15 there. I mean, it's kind of like, almost like it talks about him being tossed down to earth, and then it says, hell from beneath is excited to meet you at your coming, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then it talks about your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the maggot is spread over your worms cover you, and then it talks about this area right in here. It could be right now, and Satan still here and still mm-hmm. trying to ascend up to, you know, to above the stars of God, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's almost like it's talking about the situation right now.
And then when it gets to verse 16, is this the man who made the earth tremble?
Yeah.
Many people think that's a reference to the Antichrist there.
Mm-hmm.
That it's now gone past the king of Tyre.
He's down into hell right now.
Well, just this point. Idea that it's gone back to a man again who made the earth tremble. Mm-hmm. Someone who had tremendous power. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But doesn't it say something in here about how they gaze at him in wonderment?
Right.
They think he's, this is nothing. He's nothing. And he's the one that's done all this.
Right.
Because what we were saying before didn't say man.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is that why they're calling at Antichrist?
I'm just saying that this is like all those difficult passages where there's a mix of different things in there. Some of it is angelic. Some of it is when you die, mortal. There's a mix of mortal and angelic in here, and so when it talks about this idea that when he's eventually taken out, it's like, oh, you're just a man, and you thought you were God. It's like back in the Ezekiel 28 where it emphasizes the mortality of the king, because you say you're a God. That was in the previous passage we saw last time, but you say you're a God, but you're not. And then what God emphasizes to say that you're not a God is you're mortal. Because God alone is immortal. And so there's this whole idea that he's emphasizing mortality. And so when he's in his heyday, he's very impressive and almost looks divine. But in the end, he's just a man.
That claims to be.
Mm-hmm. So it's like almost a reverse of, in a sense, it's almost a reverse of Jesus, where this guy's just a man, and he comes across in a way that people think he's God, but he ends up just being a man. Jesus is God. Mm-hmm. He shows up as a man, and people won't believe that he's really God. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just think he's just a man, but he's really God. You see the kind of the reversal there, and so there's a sense in that Jesus came and walked the earth as a humble Jew when he's actually the living God, and here's a guy that's just a man trying to make himself out to be essentially a living God, and it's almost like, I haven't really thought about this much before, but it's almost like God has. He's seen the desire of Satan and the desire of the Antichrist and the desire of prideful man to try to be God. And in his irony and in his cleverness, he's brought redemption by taking God and showing up as a man, like reversing it. And then the whole business, like, he who must be first must be last. Mm-hmm. These guys want to be first. Jesus came to be last, right? So there's that whole tension there between those two ideas, where they're both men and they're crossing over in their appearance to people. Also notice if you back up to verse 5, which he read. In verse 4, he's taking this proverb up against the king of Babylon. And if we step back for a minute and we think Ezekiel, the whole thing of them, the Jews going off to Babylon, God in that thing is saying, I'm giving all the kingdoms of the earth and authority to Nebuchadnezzar. Don't resist him. And we think of the book of Daniel where the visions are given of the beast and the vision of the statue. So when we see Babylon, we want to think of this whole idea of the first and the last kingdoms that are Gentile, in order, Gentile kingdoms in the times of the Gentiles. Notice, like in verse 5, the Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. And that word scepter there is pretty important, I'm suggesting, because I think it's tied in with that Genesis 49:10. The scepter won't depart from Judah, nor lawgiver from between his feet till Shiloh comes. It's the scepter here is kind of like what the scepter in Ezekiel, where it says God would take out the scepter of his son Right? He'd come down and he'd do away with the king in the line of Judah because he was unrighteous. And he'd bring an end to the Jewish kings. And that's when he gives things over to Nebuchadnezzar. And now here in this passage, he's saying, I'm going to put an end to the Babylonian, the non-Jewish line, essentially, which actually is more than Babylon. It's Tyre, and you know, it's all these different things. But in this particular part here, he's saying he's going to break the scepter of the rulers who struck the people in wrath. And again, in this passage here, when it says the people, that aspect of it is talking more often about Israel. There's, like you see in the next thing, he who ruled the nations in anger, but before this says he struck the people. Whenever you see the people and the nations in the Old Testament, often they're two different words, and the word for people is often, not always, but often it's emphasizing the God's people, the nation Israel. So there's this part of what there is there in this 5 and 6 is this idea that one of the reasons he's taking out this king of Babylon is because of what he's and how he's been used, but what he's done to Israel. And so in the time of the end, the king of Babylon being essentially the Antichrist will be the same sort of thing. He'll have the scepter. He'll be coming against God's people, not just Israel, but also believers. And God's going to break his staff and his scepter. And so that's the point where this scepter here is, in the near term, it's when Medo-Persia comes and takes Babylon out, Nebuchadnezzar's rule. It's actually Belshazzar at the time, but start with Nebuchadnezzar, and then it's Belshazzar, and the Medo-Persians come in and take away Babylonian rule, but the rule is still in the hands of Gentiles. The final fulfillment here, which is, I think, brings into view this idea of Jesus is going to come, and when Jesus comes, he takes out the scepter of Babylon in the book of Revelation, and then the scepter comes back to the throne of Judah like it's supposed to be, and you get that pick up again, the end of the times of the Gentiles and the rule of the throne of David. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't think about when I think God referred to Nebuchadnezzar as his servant, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And when Nebuchadnezzar was made like to be like an animal, crawl around on all fours and everything, when he got up, wasn't he praising God? And it seemed like he was saved after that.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is referring to him, you know, that doesn't seem like somebody who is saved.
Yeah, well, again, there's this whole issue where, yeah, that's true, there's a different flavor here, but again, if it's talking about the point at which where Medo-Persia comes in, then you're looking at Daniel 5, where Belshazzar's got that feast,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
he's riding on the wall.
And he's yeah. taking the temple vessels and partying mm-hmm. with them, right? And then Daniel comes in and scolds them, essentially, and during the interpretation it says, you know, your father did this and that and that, and even though you knew these things,
mm-hmm.
you're still partying with God's goods, right?
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which Babylon here, you know, the king of Babylon is the idea of the ruler of Babylon too, right? Not just necessarily a individual.
So
and
it
that's
could be
Belshazzar.
Belshazzar,
mm-hmm.
not speaking of,
right.
of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, yeah.
But I think there's a passage that where, I think it's in Jeremiah, I don't have it right on the tip of my head right now, but where it says...
I got a pointy hat.
Yeah, on the corner. Where God says, he's giving the kingdom to Belshazzar and his son and his son's son until the time comes for the judgment of Babylon, essentially. I'm not saying it correctly, but there's an implication there that there's several rulers in the line, which many people believe is Nebuchadnezzar and then his son and then Belshazzar. right? And so that would imply that between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, the one of the other rulers in there is included. So that might be what this has in mind too, that Nebuchadnezzar started it out. The Nebuchadnezzar definitely prefigures the Antichrist. I mean, he makes a statue, an image, says worship it.
Mm-hmm.
Not just worship me, but worship the image. That's like right out of Revelation 13. And then, but like Jerry says, he's made a beast, just like the final beast, for the same period of time that the final beast will be a beast.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but he appears to come. I'm one of the ones that believes there's a split.
It sure seems like it when you read it.
Some people believe that he comes to faith, which Daniel kind of implies too, a little bit in how he chastises Belshazzar. He's more or less saying, you don't have the same view of God that your father, you know, your uncle or your grandfather
had. It could also be though, I mean, I've always had that same deal with you, you know, about being saved, but it just occurred to me that could it also just be that, okay, every knee shall bow, you will acknowledge who he is, not necessarily salvation.
I think when he came out of this thing, he came up and he was praising the God of Daniel.
Wasn't he, I believe, in chapter 4.
I've had that same view as you guys.
Yeah.
It just kind of occurred to me that, you know, could it also be, you know, I'm sure other people just think it's a case of, you know, acknowledging your God and I'm not, you know, kind of thing.
Well, he does a certain amount of lip service at the end of chapter 3 after the burning fiery furnace, but obviously at chapter 4 he hasn't learned a lesson yet.
Right.
So there are people that believe that that he did come to faith. I'm one of them that leans
that way.
And then the same with the king that sees Daniel in the burning or in the with the lion's den.
Yeah, he comes back and he's just hoping.
And he stays up all night.
Mm-hmm. Right. Worried about him.
Yeah, I'm guessing he's interceding. It doesn't say a whole lot. And then he says, "Has your God been able to save you?"
Right.
You know, so that boy, that sounds like faith.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Anyways,
yeah. So I really don't. And notice here too, in like verse 14. I will be like the Most High.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, God's got a lot of names. But that's El Elyon, which basically means, that's Elijah's name is in there. The high part, Elijah.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ascended one, the highest one. And so he's saying, I will ascend above the ascended one. Right? He's not just saying, I'm going to be higher than God with us, Emmanuel. I'm going to be higher than El Shaddai, the powerful one. I'm going to be higher than El Gabor, the mighty one. But, you know, there's all these names of God.
Mm-hmm.
He picks this name that's the highest. You know, so he's saying, I'm going to be above the name that describes the highest nature of God, his high nature. So it's like, you know, just saying, I'm going to be higher than God. I'm going to be above the title that God has as the highest one, you know. And then verse 15, yet you shall be brought down to Sheol. Right? There's this huge, you know, it's just like when in Ezekiel 28 where the guy says, I'm like God, and God says, you're going to be killed. You think you have, you know, like eternal life, I'm going to show you're mortal. Here it's like, I'm going to go the highest high you can think of. And the next verse, God says, I'm going to take you down to the very bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So, verse 17 is one of the verses I was mentioning earlier, we're almost out of time, that people... some people use to tie to teach that there was a previous age prior to Genesis 2:1-2. So, because it says here, you made the world as a wilderness, and you remember in Genesis that the world is formless and void.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so people jump in and say, "Oh, God would never make anything void, and so he didn't make it void. It's the judgment that came from this that made it void.
Yeah.
And then they bring in some other passages as well. And there's some books out there that have caught on with different people that teach this. But I don't think that's what it's talking about. I think what it's talking about is the opposite. It's saying, it's not talking about a time between Genesis 1a and 1b or whatever. It's talking about a time future. And it's bringing in the idea that it's the Antichrist that's going to make essentially the world as a wilderness by his global destruction. There's the idea where it applies, you know, it can apply to Babylon and its destructive abilities at the time this was given in a hyperbolic way. But ultimately, I think it's talking about a future thing, not something way back.